Once again, good morning, everybody. This session is Enabling and Disrupting Macro Forces Affecting the Expanding Education Ecosystem. I don't know about you, but I was intrigued by this because I didn't know half of the words that he was using here. So I said, this is going to be good. I'm going to learn something. I am pleased to introduce our speaker this morning. His name is Jan Martin Lowendahl. He is a PhD, and he has 15 years of experience in higher education, including research and teaching and IT management. Most recently, he served as a CIO, where his main focus was infrastructure strategies and governance. Dr. Lowendahl has also worked collaboratively in the academic community and has served on a number of boards. Dr. Lowendahl is now with Gartner as a research director, where his research area is higher education technology strategies, including administrative and academic systems, learning technologies, identity and access management, as well as governance. At this time, I'd like to present Dr. Lowendahl.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to see at least this many people here. I know it's 8:30, and there are 11 other concurrent sessions. I have to warn you up front, this is not going to be ordinary Gartner presentation. Because I'm like any other academic, when I finally got back down to the file and ranks in Gartner, I tried to break any rule I can. So this is actually two presentations in one. So in Gartner, we have three key issues and 18 slides. That's the format. That's what you get. So I admit I have three key issues, but I have 36 slides. So it's two Gartner presentations at the price of one. Does that sound good? Okay. So the format I'm going to try here, actually, and it's sort of more of a test format for you, so you're going to help me build our research for the future as well. And I'm actually going to revert back to the good old days of PhD training, and even as an aspiring chemist. So this is going to be much like a thermodynamics lecture. So any of you have actually had thermodynamics lectures? A few out there. Well, the format is really, you present a lot of data very quickly, and then you present a model that tries to explain the data, and then you present a lot of data again very quickly, and a model. So that's the format. And I'm going to do that twice today. And I actually have 10 minutes less than I had last time I did this. So let's see how quickly I can set the data part specifically. But you can also see it as an index, because almost any slide with the data will also have a reference to where we get that data from. So you can go and read the textbook afterwards. So, we're talking about enabling and disrupting macro forces affecting the expanding, and first we thought it was the learning ecosystem. So by doing this, you know, setting up for this presentation, we actually learned something. Because learning, we all talk about learning, but let's face it, learning should be happening everywhere. And what we're really dealing with here is the education ecosystem, where we deliberately try to teach some person's a topic or some kind of knowledge. So we're dealing here with the education ecosystem, and I'm going to talk about that later and show you what we mean by that. So, but even before talking about macro forces and trends and all the new hip things out there, I'm going to step back. Because I strongly believe that most ideas are not new. It's only a new context. Everything is a remix. If you haven't seen those videos on net, go to Google and search for Everything is a Remix. It's a really cool thing, project a person has done about that. So, education goes back even to 2000 before Christ. So in Sumer and Babylonia, they actually had something that literally was called, there was eduba, which meant tablet houses. So they had these budding scribes who wanted to learn how to write on the tablets. And there's a wonderful song or recount of the teacher, parent, and student relationship in there. And yes, even at that time, it involved tuition. A few hundred years later, some very bright scribe find out, there's a business opportunity here. So we know that actually getting to be a civil servant in the Egyptian kingdom, very high paid job, competition. So what if I produce a document to help them prep for their test? This Ahmes there, he actually did that. So he provided, at least what we know, 84 mathematical problems and how you solve them. Very useful stuff. So how do you calculate the slope of a pyramid? Obviously something you need to know in Egypt in 1550 before Christ. But also other stuff like how much grain do I need in a barn to feed a village over the dry season? I think that's very interesting stuff here. The business proposition he made was that you can get this for the cost of a small goat. What do we have today? Well, we have the geometry app provided by Collins in Great Britain for the general certificate of secondary education. So it's there to help students to prep for the certificate. It's, you know, equivalent to that today. That app costs about 1/400th of a goat. So obviously, it's hard with inflation and stuff like that, but it's probably cheaper today. However, of course, you need a device to read that app, which costs you between 1/2 of a goat to 2 goats, depending of you know how much you choose there. So when we look at trends and look at things that we want to do for the future, we need to recognize that you know education has been around forever, and it will be around forever. However, the question we have to ask us, are we the ones who are going to deliver that education? Are these macro forces that are both enabling and disrupting going to affect us in a positive way or a negative way? So, here's the Gartner side. What are the current macro forces? I'm going to spend a number of slides on that. Are they enabling or disrupting the education ecosystem? That's where I introduce the ecosystem. And what can CIOs do to cope or take advantage? That's where we get into the more detailed stuff which affects the CIOs, the technology side. And I'd like to remind you about this one. So I'm going to throw you a lot of data today, not necessarily in a very condensed way. But I hope you can come up to me and I'll explain the finer points afterwards. So the education ecosystem. In order to understand the macro forces that impact them, we try not to reinvent the wheel. So we use something called STEEP, which is society. And actually, I'm going to turn this around. It's speed this time. Society, political, environmental, economy, and technology. I save technology last because that's the most fun part. And when we look at these different macro trends, one clear macro trend when it comes to society is that servicing the service economy means a booming business for education. I know that some of your institutions are actually been a bit apprehensive because of the demographics. Locally, you see that the number of high school students actually dropping. Well, the first thing in terms of education inflation is that what used to take a high school education now takes a bachelor. What used to take a bachelor now is a master and so on. So the first takeaway there is that attracting non-traditional students is a key source in mature markets. And actually, looking at the latest OECD data, I can see that very clearly for the Nordic markets in Europe. So we have a large amount of non-traditional students coming back to higher education to get a higher degree in order to secure their jobs. And if you also look at that OECD data, you can see that the unemployment rate for lower education is much higher than for higher education. So it still pays off to have a higher degree. The other thing is that education inflation in the global sense, it is exploding. So actually, this is an interesting set of data here. It's from predictions in terms of, we can't see it all here, 16 to 64-year-olds that had a certain education. So this part here in India represents 200 million people who should have a PhD education by 2050. That's a lot of people. And actually, if you look at the data down here, so it's up 68% from 80 million in 1995 to 135 million in 2005. Another 17% to 158 million in 2008. In the US alone, it's projected to increase with 17%. to 2019. So the takeaway here is that local versus global demographics defined opportunities. And we are in a booming business if you can access the big market. The downside to this, there is a lot of other people who see this as well and are trying to take a piece of this cake. And we're going to look at that at the education ecosystem later. There's another side to this. I see a clear retreating responsibility, especially in Europe, because obviously we've had a different model than you have had here in the US, where it's been even more focused on tuition and what I call a sort of a corporate or business model even earlier. So these are examples of students revolting because the tuitions are going, in this case in the UK, from £3,000 a year to £9,000 a year, which is a pretty steep hike. And the government in the UK, they said, well, you know, it's a range. And of course we expect the Oxfords and the Cambridges to take £9,000 and then we go down to the polytechnics and they'll will take lower. Everybody, 95% of the institutions went for the 9,000. Because obviously at the same time, the politicians removed a lot of the public funding. So, there's a decreasing funding, increasing fees. We have other political things that are affecting this, like immigration issues. And they are seem to be of this notion that it's no longer going to be something that's good for society or free thing. It's a thing that the single individual takes responsibility for. And the takeaway here is that education is continuing its transformation into a business with all those cultural implications. And I know a lot of us, we didn't enter higher education to be good corporate citizens and pursue a corporate goal for the bottom line. Energy uncertainty. This is the most long-term thing. But one thing, when we look usually at the environment, we think about green. And green movement has definitely lost momentum. That's not the highest thing on anybody's list anymore. So green IT now is more about cost savings than being green. And even uncertainty about the future energy at all is taking its toll. I mean, after the earthquake and tsunami and Fukushima, Germany decided to remove all their nuclear reactors. If there's one country in the world that shouldn't be afraid for earthquake and tsunamis, it's Germany. But there you have it. And the problem I see, and this has actually started before, that you don't build a data center downtown London anymore because the power grid can't take it. And there are rolling brownouts in California a number of years ago. So even in the so-called developed countries, we're seeing that the infrastructure is being strained. And what we used to be able to take for granted, we can't anymore. So we actually, in many countries, have weak infrastructure in general. And if you want to explode the education options for students in India and China, that is going to be one rate limiting steps. And I think especially that notion that in India actually more people have access to mobile phones than they have to toilets. That's amazing. It gives you perspective. So, even uncertainty of the fundamentals of social infrastructure as a rate limiting step. Actually, that's something I picked from thermodynamics as well. I can explain that way back. So, I actually do get to use some of my chemistry knowledge now and then. So, this is data from the 2011 CIO Agenda survey. This specific cut is about 128 higher education CIOs globally out of 2014 CIOs total. So this is something we do every year in Gartner. And it's interesting to see the different trend. One thing, for instance, is that managing your environment has never, ever been in the top 10. We talk a lot about it, but we don't prioritize it. What we can see, though, is that being efficient, improving business process, improving business continuity, increasing management control is actually starting to go up the list. And obviously, in 2008, we had cost control. In 2010, then the economy crisis hit. We got it up in 3, and now it's going down again. So it looks like we hit the peak of the cost issue. And that brings us to the new normal. And to be honest, if you remember, that data was actually collected around last part of last year. So the double dip kind of thinking hadn't really hit us with the Greece crisis and the job package and stuff like that. But even then we could see that there was going to be a new normal, and the new normal is about cost control. Irrespective of good or bad times. So more demand for ROI in advance, more regulation everywhere. You need more transparency. The takeaway is really that with uncertainty comes control, better understanding of the relation of income to cost. And that's something I presented in a note down there, which it's no longer about cost. It actually is about yield. And that simple equation over there is going to is representing that. But at the same time, it's also about keeping your end users happy, which is a really hard balance to do. And I didn't mention this. My focus is emerging trends, strategy, and governance. And emerging trends feed into strategy. Strategy is useless unless you can execute on it. So that's how I'm working. So that is actually part of how I try to illustrate to senior management that you need bigger buckets to do the savings. Don't look at IT alone. You need to look at in the context of the process and the people in order to see. And I actually think we should increase the budgets of IT, because that is the way to be more efficient in the institution as a whole. Unfortunately, a lot of institutions only look at the technology part and the cost part and doesn't put it in the full context. So, more data. Again, another CEO report here. One thing we can see, this is very cyclical. And we can expect it to go back up and forth. Globally, we're now going back up the slope again. And this is also illustrated by this chart, but it's also regional. So you can see the perception of North Americans is that only 11% was going to have a decreasing IT budget. And this is the higher ed respondents split up for different regions. I knew that UK would be high on decreasing, because they were really hit hard by both government and changing tuition structures. I was really taken aback that APAC had this. APAC is Asia Pacific, so mostly actually in our surveys, mostly Australia and New Zealand. So we have some Hong Kong and some Singapore as well, but not much Chinese or Indian, which you perhaps would expect. So you really need to see this in the broader picture and deep down sometimes to regions as well. So now to the fun stuff. And the first thing here is, of course, a lot of these things we know, but I want to go through them anyway. The first thing we have here, of course, is the death of business. We now have more than 2 billion users on the internet. That's a sizable chunk of the world population, actually. And that's an infrastructure in itself. But we also see something even more cool, that when you add consumerization, actually today we have more than 5 billion subscriptions out there. And in countries like Saudi Arabia, of course, they have 2.7 or so per person. That's how you get to those kind of numbers. But it's amazing. The cheaper these phones get, the more we definitely get. But on top of this, we get something really interesting. We get second-order infrastructures. So Facebook, which now has 0.66 billion users, it's a second-order infrastructure which some vendors use to deliver their content. Like KNO, they are going to deliver textbooks on the Facebook. And here's something really interesting, why this is happening. How many of you actually look at TED Talks? Excellent. So, have you seen the TED Talk There was a woman who was a digital anthropologist who had a physicist father and made a comment about consumerization, especially cell phones. No? Okay. I'll tell you the story. And the physicist thing actually has a bearing here. And I have a cord here, so if you see me trip over, you understand why. Because I need a paper for this one. I'm going to make 2 points here. I'm going to ask you, okay, what's the shortened distance between 2 points? Straight line. Okay, let's have a straight line here. Okay, remember, this woman had a physicist father. So, it's the wrong answer. Well, actually, it's one answer. But if you have enough energy, you can bend time and space, and the shortest distance is basically zero. And that is, in the physicist terms, called a wormhole. And her connection, which I think is great, her connection was actually, we're walking around with wormholes in our pockets. And what do you get when you have wormholes in your pockets? You get Facebook as the third largest nation in the world. They grew 250 million users during 2010 alone. And I bet you that the smartphones was a big part of that. So, obviously, there are things here that are increasing the options in terms of what we, how we do things, tremendously. And one of the key things is to try to understand what are they, how are they going to impact us, and that's actually what we excel at Gartner. So we produce things like the Emerging Trends Radar Screen, and you have to talk to people like Jackie Fenn and Steve Prentice to really understand what all of these things mean and why they're on there. But I think actually this part is not the real interesting part. The real interesting part is this part. So how can you build strategic capabilities on top of technologies? And here's another version of seeing it with Mark Ryskin and Jorge Lopez. So they went through and actually made a hype cycle on capabilities and looking at the technical underlying things with them. And you can clearly see there's not one option, there are many options. And the question now becomes, are these enabling or disrupting for the education ecosystem? Well, first of all, we need to understand what the education ecosystem is all about. This is something we developed 2 years back, which is very helpful when I go to senior faculty, senior academic leadership, in trying to tell them, you know, there's no one size fits all. There are actually several different business models. And actually, most institutions out there accept the word business model today, which is quite interesting. There is definitely a shift out there. So if you go to the traditional strategic plan of an institution, you often see the, we want to be the only SUs. We want to be the exclusive, academically defined quality thing, the Oxfords and the Harvards. The bulk of the institutions are accreditation-defined quality, very inclusive, the public, big public universities or the community colleges. If you go down here, you have the community-defined quality, which is usually the business schools. And if you go even further down here, you have things like, I decide what I want to do because I have a goal like a job or just a personal education goal. And then we have the Phoenixes and the UK Open Universities of the world. And actually, taking it back to that level means that a lot of academic leadership actually have to recognize there is no one-size-fits-all. And if you want your IT department to support you for your strategic goal for the future, you have to tell them in simple words where you're going. This picture, though, is too small. So the education ecosystem has grown much, much bigger. And in order to try to understand this, we devised this kind of graphic model here. So you have the core, which is K-12 and higher education, that is rooted in sort of the public education system. Then you have all the starting to be external things like Statistics.com or Live Mocha. So how many of you have heard about Live Mocha, for instance? Some of you have. Well, I think that's one of the more cool things out there right now, because they started a few years back with the idea that we can do language training much better than anybody else with social tools. So it's a social software language learning site where they connect people who want to learn a language with native speakers of that language. So the native speaker would correct your pronunciation when you record it. And you do quizzes, you do translations and stuff like that. And they own reputation points. They calculate that they need about 700,000 recurring users to make this a sustainable community. Within 1.5 years, they had 1.85 million users. Now, the last time I talked to them, which is actually a year ago or so, they have 5 million users. I think that's amazing. So obviously there's something in there. And I know that a lot of community colleges and big public universities, for them, language training is actually the bread and butter of a lot of the courses. Obviously some kind of competition here. Statistics.com is even more focused on higher education because they have a value proposition that few universities can have. They say, we bring in the best statisticians in the world, the renowned people. We actually even take them from your universities, and we give specialized courses online. And you, well, usually you have a hopefully a good general mathematician in your institution that gives all kinds of courses, including statistics. But we're the best of the best. And the thing that's the killer here, it actually gets you accredited university points, which you can use back home. So that's a few examples of what we got out there. But we all realize that what used to be do-it-yourself, 50 years ago, we basically did it all ourselves. Today, we're starting to use a number of different tools out there. And most of us actually cannot be out of these tools. We need them. They've been so fundamental now that we can't live without them. Of course, introducing another axis here, context to content. Of course, McGraw-Hill and Pearson, the publisher, have almost always been around, but they're working on that side. The next level down there is services. So not only do we get actual tools that we bring in and use ourselves, we also buy services directly. So you have things like Moodle Room, and you have things like Blackboard, so it's kind of straddling the line there. You can either buy it or you can buy it as a service. What's happening here, and this is the next step, and there's where it's going to get messy. I don't know, in thermodynamics we have something called the Brownian motion. So it's when molecules in gas, they hit each other and they move around. It's kind of like this here. I'm going to try to see which dots or molecules here is actually connected to others. So Pearson, very early on, got something very interesting. They understood that we are a content provider, but in order to deliver to education, we need a context provider. And Fronter is an LMS from Norway, which actually started to be used for higher education. Now it's more used for K-12. And actually, they've turned it into an offering called PowerSchool. You probably know eCollege better over here. So they bought eCollege a few years back. Same principle. McGraw-Hill weren't as bold. So they kind of stayed in the content area and bought Tegrity, which is a lecture capture and retrieval system. So it's not so much context and social and stuff like that. It's more like how do we get more context content, and how can we control it better, basically. Pearson then did something cool. They teamed up with Live Mocha. So basically you mashed up the Live Mocha content with the Pearson content with social software. And they gave you an option of buying this for $19.95 a month. And suddenly you had the quality controlled content through that medium. Something even more interesting was that Live Mocha actually had the idea to hire teachers. You could get a personal mentor in the system. However, that didn't scale. So what did they do? Well, way back when they actually only had 3 million users, they asked their users, how many of you are teachers, accredited teachers? Guess what? 300,000 of them were accredited teachers. So they devised a system that if you, as an accredited teacher, actually correct quizzes and stuff like that, you get money. It's not a lot of money, but it's based on how many of these corrections you do. We talked about statistics.com. Pearson then moved on and understand we don't only need to deliver in a context, we also need to get integrated in the context itself, the metadata. So which students are there, which courses, so they're connected to Banner. And we, when we saw this, we kind of think, you know, it's going to only be a matter of time before they actually deliver directly to the student. So 4 weeks ago, they bought Connections Educations. So that's an accredited online learning for K-12. So now they sell directly to students. So the question is, how long is this going to be before they do that with higher ed? And there is something later on in the presentation. Blackboard has a totally different strategy. So they want to be the one-stop shop for everything, services and tools within the institution. So they're studying mostly on the context side. They do have deals with Pearson and McGraw and all these others, but that's not the same thing as actually buying them or the vice versa. They even do things like emergency response system, which is basically, I think, outside education ecosystem. But, of course, they bought Wimba, web conferencing, they bought Presidium, which is a support organization, which I think was a good move for them, by the way. No more comments. But then, you know, in this ecosystem, Presidium actually already supported Moodle. So, you know, as a Moodle user with Presidium, I should be starting to be thinking about things. So now I actually have a solution which is competitor to the owner of my supporter. So, again, ecosystems are very entangled. Moodle Rooms, they take Moodle, put it into Joule, they integrate it with other SISs, and they deliver it in Dell Cloud. Again, a new option for delivery. MyFit, again, a very interesting thing here. So MyFit was a startup 2 years ago, I think they started. They actually harvest social sites like Facebook. And they claim that they can take about 250 data points, use an algorithm, and help students match themselves with the perfect college, the perfect student-college match, based on all the data that other students put out there on their experience of their college. So they plan to sell this in three ways. Of course, ad-based in Facebook, directly to the students. A small fee to parents, because let's face it, the parents are the investors in their child's future. And eventually to the recruitment officers in higher ed. However, career advice firm who works with the K-12 bought them about a year ago. So they're now a part of the tool set for career advisors in K-12. So, have you heard about the National Center for Academic Transformation? Yes, a few of you. Well, actually, it's an interesting thing here, because they are a service that claim that if you take their help and redesign your course, I mean, this should be rather big courses, we're talking 400 or 500 students here, and do it fully hybrid. On average, they say you can save 37% of your delivery cost. On average. I think that's rather impressive. Of course, we haven't looked really into this and corroborated it, but I think it's an interesting model. TuTutor is another interesting thing. They basically say, give us your professors and curriculum, and we'll do the marketing, admissions, we provide you e-learning platform, and all the administration needed with that. And then we split the revenue. And I know we have USC representatives in here. And there's a rumor, and I have to state this, it's a rumor, that USC made several million dollars in this in just a couple of years. I did a roundtable at USC last Monday, and they didn't want to confirm or deny. So, in the K-12 business, there's actually been something for a long time, which is the opposite. We train your teachers and give you the curriculum, and you do the delivery. And they've actually been around for at least 20 years or something like that. So looking at the ecosystem, it's actually a lot of no new ideas but new context as well. From a technology point, this is the coolest thing I've seen in a number of years. It's PlugJam. So PlugJam claimed, I'll tell you why I say claimed, any of your five major student information systems, any of your five major e-learning systems, will connect them in a SOA in the cloud, platform as a service in the cloud. And we even connect them with open courseware stuff like Merlot and give you social capabilities based on that. And, you know, as a technologist, you know, I think that's rather cool. I even can buy the SOA in the cloud. But actually, that's not the real value proposition here. The real value proposition is, in order to be able to do that, you actually need a rather cool metadata system. And if you have that, you can start doing a lot of student analytics. So what did the students like? What did they actually read? Where did they go? That kind of thing. So that's a really cool thing. Unfortunately, when I talked to them, and I actually wrote in the Cool Vendors report earlier this year, I got the sense they're not going to make it. And they didn't. So this product is no longer on the market. However, they've retained the copyright, the intellectual property rights to this model. So unfortunately, unless somebody buys them, we're not going to see this in the market. And the problem, I think, is that they provided a toolbox, and they also sold mostly to CIOs. They should have provided a service and sold to VPs for education. So I'm doing it for time. I have 15 more minutes. Good. And of course, I can't pass this one up. So Pearson last week said, hey, why pay for your LMS? We'll give it away for free. Of course, it's not really for free because they have sort of something in the back of the mind when they do this. So they want to do, everyone says they want to do a Google, but you know, it's more like a Hotmail thing. So they go out and provide a free service in order to be able to, you know, basically get people weaned on their products eventually. And unfortunately, it's so new. You probably know more about this than I do, because I've been locked up in Orlando for the last week, and you've got all the sessions here about that. And that's one of the reasons I'm sure you know that we actually signed a deal or contract or agreement, probably, with EDUCOURSE. Collaboration agreement. So we are going to collaborate more with EDUCOURSE in the future, which I'm really looking forward to. So, cool vendor reports. Then the last part, and now I really have to do this speedily, which is okay. In the CIO servicing, we have three questions. What is strategic for the institution? What is the CIO strategy? And what is the CIO technology priority? So I'm trying to do sort of a heat map here of the different things that came up there. And obviously, this is something you need to ponder about at home. But it's clear that everybody now is looking for developing a flexible infrastructure in the CIO ranks. And when I saw this first, I was thinking, you know, haven't they learned a single thing the last 5 years? It's not about the technology. It's about what you actually deliver to the end users and learners. So I was actually really disappointed by this. And as you can see, at this level, there are actually some differences. And in the US case, consolidation of IT operations is something that's actually done now. It's hard to interpret this stuff sometimes, because they could be low because you've already done it, or they could be low because you've not yet thought about it. So you really have to look at longer trends, and we have that kind of data as well. So if we take the next level of question, and I think this is interesting. There, you can see from the heat map here that there are some discrepancies here in the different regions. But the more you get to the technology level, and I'm talking all industries because I've done this with all industries, the more alike it does. We're so driven by the hype cycle, more than we want to think, probably. So almost everyone is doing the cloud computing, except UK. They want business intelligence again. It's probably doing to do, you know, how do we spend our money, that kind of thing. So cloud computing and flexible infrastructure is going to save our day apparently. Another way of looking at this, and I'm using our strategic technology map here, what's good for the organization up here and what's good for the individual down here. So these are usually ERPs, these are iPads and stuff like that. The top 10 list, it's actually not too bad. The only thing is that most of the first top 5 is in the cold case, that's infrastructure. But it becomes even more interesting when you start looking at the other dots out there. What are the things that didn't make the top 10 list? And these things will be available to you, so you can start checking about that. But things like CRM wasn't in there, analytics wasn't in there, even if BI was in there. But I guess, you know, we need to understand what we're talking about here, in a sense. Anyway, so what can CIOs do to cope or take advantage? What should you be doing more of? This is another central slide I use a lot, and I even used it when I was a CIO. So when you look at the service issue you're supposed to deliver, look at the functionality. Is it specific or general? If you look at the need, is it local or global? The first thing I usually did was to make sure I didn't meddle with the researcher, establish a boundary of trust with them, so that I, as a chemist, could keep my 8 different chemistry programs, because I really need them. Of course, you can patch and upgrade my computer. That's fine. The next thing is to understand where do central IT really add value, because we understand the institution, things like the cycles, the culture, and that kind of thing. And also, of course, talking internally with IT department. Which are the stuff we shouldn't be doing anymore? Because it's too global in general. Email, for instance. However, nowadays, we used to hear a lot about, you know, your stuff is not working, people are banging on our doors, and we try to work with them in terms of that. Today, we have the consumerization in the cloud. And the consumerization in cloud with microsourcing, that's when they go directly to Google and Microsoft and Mendeley and Zotero and all those kind of things, means that you're not even going to hear about if they're disappointed. They are scoot right past you into the cloud. So, what we did, and I'm really interested in this, you know, what can we push out into the cloud or sourcing anyway, so we can actually spend more time on the important stuff? So we have done a number of sourcing surveys. And this is also the IT key metrics data. And we've done a specific sourcing survey, which I will flip through very quickly soon. What we did was to look at education first. But then we realized, why look at education? We're at the bottom of the list. So how are we going to get any best practices for an industry who doesn't do this, basically? So we started looking at a near neighbor, which in 2009 actually had 21% and we had 8. And education here is including K-12 as well. Actually, higher ed is about 12 on average, in a sense. So we actually did a survey trying to find out, you know, where are the trends? And it turns out that both for government and higher ed, we're increasing. Our strategy is to increase the sourcing. And the key here is actually to see where are the learning opportunities between different industries. And the first thing here is actually that in higher ed, only 13% say that they have a sourcing strategy, documented sourcing strategy. In government, 54% say. So that's the first opportunity for learning. And I should also point out that this year I could only do EMEA. I don't have statistically significant stuff, but together with how we talk to our clients, we can see trends at least. But I could see clear survey fatigue from our American friends. So please take this year's survey so that I can include you in next year's presentation. Because in the agreement, we also have that at least two Gartner analysts are invited back for topics you wanted here. So, very quickly, 2011, there's more green than red, means that they want to do more outsourcing today. In 2013, it's even more, so the trend is clear. And here's the thermodynamics part, because I'm flipping like mad. What are we outsourcing? Well, it turns out we're actually outsourcing the customer-facing stuff. You know, and from a sort of a logical thinking, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you have control of your customer? Well, it turns out that the Blackboard service and all that kind of thing actually plays a role here. And it depends what part of this, the thing you outsource, and we'll get back to that. Which is clearly very different from government. So that's also another area where we can actually learn from each other. The key one here is also, I think, generic collaboration and learn. They haven't done a lot of email outsourcing. We have. So there should be a lot of opportunity for mutual helping out, actually. We also looked at what kinds of outsourcing they did. So at the top is still IT skill external sourcing. So basically we buy people with more skill because we don't have the skill in-house or we can't find it, that kind of thing. Going down the list, the one that I was mostly interested in was both open source projects and cloud services. And it's interesting to see that both of them are going to be increasing over time. And specifically, the cloud service, if you look at them, and it's in looking at software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service, we see that today it's almost all software as a service, and we're beginning to see infrastructure as a service, like storage and stuff like that. And we're definitely going to see an increase over time. And actually, from the CIO survey, I think this is amazing. Everyone said that we will place more than 50% of our infrastructure services in the cloud by 2015. Actually, more than 60% in all the cases. I don't understand how we're going to have time to do that. Usually in most institutions, these are heavy things to change. But let's see. So why do we do this? Well, this is, I think, is fun. In top three, it's actually to reduce time to delivery. That's our biggest problem, apparently. It's not about cost saving, if you look at the top three. In government, it's very much about a lack of skills. And I think we're fortunate in that sense, because in higher ed, we actually have a lot of direct access to this kind of thing. But if you look at the first, the one that takes first, actually 20% say cost saving. So there's a definite balance there. While the lack of skills is consistent for government. In the reasons why not, it used to be strategy. And I thought that was a catch-all for I don't want to. But now it's interesting. It's more about complex infrastructure. So we can't do it because we have a mess internally, basically. And now it's actually starting to make sense, the thing about flexible infrastructure, that that's a top priority. And obviously, strategy to keep competencies the same in government. So, cost is the one. This, you should know, this is EMEA. So we have a lot of problems with the VAT. So as soon as we go outside our institution, we have to pay something like 12 to 25% extra on our services. Unless you're in Sweden, because the government there actually understood that that was a hinder for market things. So in this context, there's another model. Because it's not the question about build or buy or, you know, in the cloud or hosting. It's much more complex than that. So first you have the means of production and acquisition, going from build, open source, community source, consortium, and subscribe and eventually buy. And then you have, do you have it on your personal device, mobile or laptop, under the desk, data center, managed service, hosted, and all the way up to the public cloud. And the options we're starting to have today is things like the high-performance computer, either we do it in our own data center, or we push it out into the cloud. We can separate those options. The FileMaker attendance app the professor built and run on under the laptop is now the iOS attendance app. The learning management system we can do in the data center, or we can do it as a hosted service, or we can do what they did in South Africa for a while, take Sakai into the IBM cloud. We can run our student information system, Qali, or in this case, the financial system in the data center. We can do Banner as a managed service. We can do our consortium system. This is a student information system for 48 institutions in Sweden, which actually are hosted by three different computer centers which are owned by the institutions themselves. Or we can do a shared cloud as a federated identity and access management. And finally, we have this interesting stuff here. The Microsoft offices we used to buy, now we can actually do it in the cloud. We can do the WordPress as sort of a community source in the cloud. Or we can do Mendeley in the cloud. So we can see that the options are really increasing. And we need to think about this as in terms of how do we acquire the functionality? And then how do we deliver that functionality? But before you do that, the key thing here is to have a flexible infrastructure, service-oriented architecture again. So this is a case study I wrote about the Open University of Catalonia, who realized that at 5 years into their mission, there's a 16-year-old institution, they had a legacy problem. So they wanted to go from this to the, and I love the origami thing here. Whatever device you have, you should be able to deliver to the academics, the pedagogical model they can. So they bought, actually they didn't bought, they built an open source enterprise bus. And that enterprise service bus actually enabled them to not only use Sakai and Moodle at the same time, but also plug in Google Apps, other web tools, do WordPress as well, on the same identity and access management infrastructure. So I think in the future, flexible infrastructure is actually one of the prerequisites to get to a more pedagogically sound environment. And that's where I'm going to stop. Thank you.